this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and Dell. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by Washington Post reporter Ed O'Keefe and AFGE National Vice Presidents Dorothy James and Jane Nygaard. You'll also hear Jason Fornicola's interview with former NASA astronaut Dr. Bernard Harris. Welcome to Inside Government, Ed O'Keefe.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the Washington Post report that was released this week about the perception of government employees in their work.
Well, overall, it found that most Americans, frankly, think that federal workers are overpaid, underqualified, and not nearly doing enough work during the hours in which they're at the office or out in the field. It's a pretty discouraging set of numbers, I think, for the biggest defenders of federal workers, the unions, Democratic lawmakers, and, of course, the rank and file themselves, and shows you that there's a lot of work to do when it comes to reforming the perception across the country of federal workers. I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that this is coming at a time when the Republicans obviously are targeting federal workers as part of their government spending cuts, or the proposed government spending cuts on the campaign trail. Comes at a time in the recession when obviously there are a lot of people out of work, and they see the federal government continuing to hire new workers and give, even if they're just minuscule pay raises, to those that are on the payroll right now.
Was there any differentiation in the polling? Because, I mean, I'm wondering, is this about all federal employees? Is it about FBI agents, DEA agents, the Border Patrol? I mean, people putting their lives on their line. Was that factored in, or was it just sort of a generic poll?
As much as as you guys and others, I think, would have liked to have seen apples-to-apples specific comparisons, no. This is a broad swath at federal civilian workers, those that work for all those agencies you mentioned and all the others. Obviously, that's a bone of contention, I think, for some who looked at the numbers this week and said, well, you're not doing specific comparisons, government lawyers to private lawyers, government doctors to private doctors, TSA agents to local police officers. And that's understandable, but what we really wanted to do with this, I think, more than anything, is sort of establish a baseline from which we can take a look at this in the future. You know, it hasn't been really since the early 1980s, during one of the last recessions, that we really devoted some time and thought to asking the country about federal workers specifically. And I'll tell you, you talk to people across the country, you phone some of these people back and ask them some deeper questions. It's very difficult for them to differentiate between the local city engineer and the federal worker that they may have talked to on the phone on the Medicare helpline. So, I think, to some extent, the nation doesn't care what branch of the government or what level of government you're working for. They just see government worker and they have their perceptions, as confused and nuanced as they may be.
Yeah, I mean, some of us were talking before the show about the guy running, I think it's up in New York, on the rent is too darn high party. I mean, it's like asking somebody, is your rent high? Well, everybody's going to say, yeah. And when you look at the federal government, if you're just going to make it an amalgam of everything, then, it's hard to look at. When you start differentiating specifics, as you're mentioning, was there another part to the poll that when you start talking about people who actually interact with the federal government, they have a very different view?
They do. Among those that have had contact with someone in the last year, we found that they generally had a more favorable view. And that's to be expected. I think you could say that about any group of people that people do or do not have a good opinion of. In this case, we found that, they had, for the most part, said that their experience was good, that the workers seemed to know what they were doing and it didn't done their job very well or well. And that gave them sort of a generally favorable, a more favorable opinion. I think in many cases, it's people who, are related to or live with or married to a federal worker. In other cases, it's people who, may have had to call a Social Security helpline or went through airport security or there's some other federal service. Maybe they had a great experience with a park ranger at one of the national parks. But for those that didn't, their perceptions were not nearly as good. And we should note that even among those Republicans and self-identified conservatives who had had contact with a federal worker, they not only still had bad perceptions, they also, for the most part, overall thought that they had not done their job very well.
Now, that's an interesting distinction, I guess, that whatever preconceived notions you have kind of get validated. Is that sort of what you were finding?
Well, I think what it shows you is that, you know, Republicans and conservatives especially are angry about and concerned about federal workers, the quality of them, the number of them, the fact that they're better compensated. And that's no surprise when you consider that Republican leaders and Republican candidates are out there right now pushing a so-called pledge to America that includes government cuts that would reduce salaries. If possible, they would also put in a hiring freeze. There's some talk of proposing furloughs for federal workers, at least non-security ones. So when you have Republican candidates and commentators out there pushing those types of ideas, and Republicans are hearing them and agreeing with them, that's obviously going to impact their overall opinion.
And of course, a lot of federal employees and folks here in D.C. remember back to the 90s when the federal government shut down for a while and what that actually did. I mean, things you wouldn't even think about, but you're trying to get a passport to go overseas. If you're trying to get your Social Security, processed, or your, any benefit from the federal government processed, when you're talking about maybe even environmental inspections and things like that, I mean, it has a tremendous impact across the board if you try to furlough federal employees.
It would, and I think you're right that it may take a reminder like that to sort of change these opinions. But certainly we're more than 15 years since that shutdown, and we're in a completely different economic climate, and I think that's what's on people's minds and driving a lot of their opinions.
And do you think that maybe it's just an election era thing, or do you think if the election goes a certain way and people try to implement this, I mean, I know you guys have done a lot of reports on the fact that the baby boomers are close to retirement. If you start hacking the pay or the benefits of federal employees, might a lot of these people leave in quick succession with nobody to really come in their place?
The polling certainly didn't ask that, and it would be foolish to try to draw any conclusions on that specifically, but certainly, yeah, that is a concern, I think, not only among the unions and the agencies themselves and some lawmakers I've spoken to recently. Whether or not that is picked up on by the rest of the country beyond the Beltway, beyond people who know and live with federal workers, I think that remains to be seen. Is 40,000 plus people leaving in 6 months because they're ready to retire once the economy gets better going to get noticed? It's hard to say. And it could be situational and agency by agency. But certainly, if there were for some reason some very quick mass exodus of people going into retirement, I think the rest of the country might take it.
And, when people compare the public sector and private sector, I mean, obviously there's certain limits on federal pay that in the private sector, I mean, if you're in sales, for instance, potentially your salary could be unlimited, depending on how much you sell. When you look at certain things like the Security Exchange Commission, where people might come in as lawyers for a couple of years and then leave and make astronomical salaries in the private sector, how do you think it is that people are looking at this saying that federal employees are overpaid?
Well, they not only think they're overpaid, they also think that their benefits package is too generous and that if they screw up, they don't get fired. And that, I think, is really what they're concerned about. Yes, lawyers, celebrities, sports stars, they may make big amounts of money, but they're also held accountable. If they don't win the game, they don't get a contract renewal. If the radio host who makes millions of dollars doesn't get the ratings, he gets canceled. If, if a movie star doesn't do well at the box office, they don't get hired to do another movie. But at the federal government level, often when goals aren't met, when, expectations are not met, when there's waste, fraud, and abuse, I think the general public looks at that and says, well, how come people aren't losing their jobs? Because for the most part, they aren't. I think only in the most egregious cases and only after years of appeals and years of sort of getting demoted and moved around do people maybe finally leave. And that's their perception, and that's part of their anger. And frankly, I think that is a justifiable one that, gets talked about when you look at performance management options and the future of all that, and that if perhaps there was some more accountability, you'd see a difference in opinion on those questions.
Well, and in terms of looking for that, I know candidates for at least the last 30 years have talked about it at both the federal, state, and local level, running on the issue of, cutting waste, fraud, and abuse. And last time I looked, that wasn't a line item in anybody's budget. Is anybody being specific on what they want to cut? I mean, I know there's across-the-board cuts, which if you're working in a federal prison in maximum security and there's a 5% cut, I mean, what 5% of the time do you not want these inmates looked at? I mean, what are they looking at actually cutting?
Well, I've spoken in the last week with, I think, three or four different Republican lawmakers and asked them that question, and they said, the throwaway answer, that everything's on the table. So take that what you will. But I think that what there is immediately is a preference to institute a one-year hiring freeze at the least, and spend that year trying to sort out where there might be an opportunity to either cut jobs through attrition or potentially through layoffs. And remember that even President Obama just late last week told a bunch of reporters that furloughs and attrition is something he may have to consider. So it's not exclusive to Republicans, though the president himself also didn't provide any specifics. And it looks as if there may be an appetite to at least consider this early in the new year.
And, I mean, for federal employees who listen, I know there's a feeling amongst a lot of federal employees that, you know, what's going to happen is going to happen anyway, that, you know, this is just how things are, that there won't be any furloughs, there won't be any layoffs, there won't be any hiring freezes like this, that, you know, things will just continue as they are. Do you think that you're finding that, I mean, this discussion is not just a political ploy, I mean, this is something that's gaining some traction?
I think it is starting to gain some traction, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's only one or two lines in a 28-page Republican Pledge to America, but even, you know, when you have the president talking about 5% budget cuts at agencies, and the fact that we're close to the administration probably telling at least some of them to expect 5% budget cuts, that inevitably means they're going to have to look at people and not just resources, and, you know, people being the most valuable resource. So I do think that we're getting to a point where it may have to be considered. That said, when was the last time a federal budget was actually passed? It's been at least two fiscal years. So who knows if there'll actually be one again next year, and maybe these spending arguments and discussions about government cuts would lead to such a point where it won't happen. But I do suspect we're going to be at a point where there's a serious discussion about cuts that includes people, if only because the political climate is asking for it. And for anyone who doesn't think that it might not happen, I would urge you to look overseas to countries that I also think don't think thought they were going to have to be in this position. You saw the UK this week announcing government layoffs, Greece, of course, Spain, and others looking at it. And what's to say that at some point, if the conditions don't improve here, we may have those same problems.
And as we come into our last 30 seconds, there's a general perception that this breaks down by political party. It's always easy for people outside of Washington to kind of bash Washington. But do you think the fact that so many federal employees are actually employed outside of Washington at military bases, VA hospitals all over the country, Social Security offices, Border Patrol folks outside, do you think that maybe some of these politicians, once they get elected from either party, might have to start looking inside their districts and seeing that this could have a huge economic impact if these federal employees lost jobs or got furloughed?
Well, look at Jason Chaffetz. A good example. He's a Republican from Utah. He's the ranking member on the workforce subcommittee in the House. He's got a lot of federal workers in his Salt Lake City district, but he's still talking about it. So I think some of them may have to do that and may realize that what always happens with candidates who become lawmakers and office holders. But I think to some extent you will also see some stick to their guns and really make this a big, important issue. And I would point out one thing. I think, you know, this is a pretty discouraging set of numbers for people who are close to this situation, but note the fact that among younger people, they had a much more optimistic outlook on government in this poll than older people. And younger people were more apt than senior citizens to suggest to their friends and to others that may just be coming out of school to go look at government careers. So I think there's, you know, while we may be entering a period where there's going to be some pretty tricky and difficult political discussions about the future of the federal workforce, remember that at least the younger generation seem to have a more optimistic viewpoint. Is that because they haven't had any interaction with the government as much as older people? Is that because of President Obama and his sort of appeal to younger voters? You know, that remains to be seen. But there is a silver lining out there that may bring some hope to those that are a little discouraged.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Research shows continuing your education is the best way to increase your earning potential. Grantham University can give you the education you've always wanted. With their exclusive partnership with AFGE, you'll receive discounted tuition available to AFGE members and their families. Grantham's degree programs are 100% online to fit your busy schedule. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE. AFGE.
Want a new PC? Only Dell can offer AFGE members the lowest prices guaranteed. During the month of October, double your AFGE discount on all Dell PCs. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Dorothy James, AFGE's District 7 National Vice President. Welcome back to Inside Government.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. So let's talk a little about this Washington Post poll. I know you're out in the Chicagoland area, but I'm sure everybody out there, it's a federal employee, has been reading about it and describing Americans as having some negative feelings about federal employees. What's been the reaction out there?
Well, I think employees are dismayed, especially when we have such dedicated employees performing such important work for the government. We are the people that protect the borders. We are the people that care for the veterans. We're the people that protect the nation from terrorists, and we safeguard the prisoners, and we inspect the meat, the water, the air quality, and we process Social Security checks, and we administer the Medicare system, and we also protect against foreign combatants. We think our work is very important, and if it wasn't, these agencies wouldn't be established. And we also believe it's what the public wants. They want these protections.
Now, did you find it interesting, as I did, that the same poll also noted that people who interact daily or directly with the different federal agencies come away with positive feelings about their experiences dealing with federal employees?
Right, and it seems as though 3 out of 4 people who interact with federal workers have this type of attitude toward the federal government and the federal employees. We probably don't have enough people that are interacting, but those people that do find that federal employees are worthwhile. They're not lazy. They do their job. They do outreach. They do try to give them the service that they're expecting. But it doesn't mean that they're 100% perfect, because we are experiencing shortages, and there is also the anticipation of even more shortages with furloughs that are being proposed, the 5% cut that Obama is recommending because of the budget defect is probably something the administration feels that has to be introduced, and that's just not here in the U.S. I understand that even in Europe, there's a 5% across the board federal spending being proposed. What that's going to do, it's going to reduce the efficiency that's involved with the federal employees. And when it comes to, for instance, IRS not being able to have sufficient staff to collect taxes, that's less revenue for the American people. Or when it comes to any agency that is not considered as a security agency, and those security agencies would be DOD, Homeland Security, Veterans Administration, these organizations will provide less protections to the American public. Those organizations that I mentioned, the Bureau of Prisons especially, what would happen is that the public would be at risk for not being able to house violent criminals, and even the communities that surround these Bureau of Prisons would be at higher risk if understaffing develops and continues. Right now, EPA has done a tremendous job with additional staff in overseeing toxic waste and reporting abuses to the federal government. Those things are definitely going to be diminished. Meat inspectors, they've confiscated tons of infected meat and kept it off of the public tables. We, as the public, would be certainly more at risk if we're losing 1,300 food inspectors. So that's an escalating type of scenario for the public. It's penny wise and pound foolish, because the result is less protection for what the American public feels is important to them.
And let's break that down a little bit. I mean, you know, when somebody does something as simplistic as saying a 5% cut, if you're talking about, say, the Bureau of Prisons, what 5% of the day are we not going to be guarding our prisoners? I mean, does it really work out into that, or just delays for service? If you want a passport, if it took a week, is it going to take two because somebody's been furloughed?
Well, first of all, you'd have to consider that these organizations were not fully staffed to begin with. Because there were cuts, there were freezes and vacancies, and those freezes result in shortages. And if you're going to compound that with an additional 5%, then there is definitely risk involved.
And think about the varying numbers of job descriptions. And you did an excellent job going through all of the various ones, but let's highlight a couple. I mean, I think when we talk about the people that maybe interact with the government and they have a different view, that might be people maybe at Social Security or the VA, something like that. But if you think about civilians at DOD facilities that are maybe mechanics working on tanks or people that are doing support staff work that the civilians at DOD facilities do, you're not going to get the general public interacting with those people. Do you think it's fair for them to be subjected to this kind of these kind of cuts or also this kind of attitude?
Well, what happens, from what I can see, if there is a crisis, then the public becomes alarmed. For instance, when we didn't have the armor plated for the vehicles in Iraq, the public was very much alarmed about the safety and welfare of the soldier. But after that crisis abated, then it's business as usual. Then we're overstaffed, we're bureaucratic, we're sluggish, and we're lazy, and we're too expensive. Certainly it is important to wind down war efforts, but it's also important that a certain level of protection, a certain level of technology advancement be involved in the Department of Defense. We cannot be laggards and slackers as other countries continue to improve in their technology and their war implementation. So these things are things that the public wants.
And, you know, when you think of a federal employee, I guess a lot of times, folks, when you compare the private sector to the public sector, you think that in the private sector, maybe you have a lot of sales kind of jobs that can boom and bust with the economy, that sort of thing. But when you think about the federal government, you are actually hiring rocket scientists. I mean, you actually are hiring people with PhDs, with master's degrees that do policy level work that really doesn't compare with the private sector. Isn't that right?
Well, you know, what I see, the government is hiring professional and technical employees. And at the same time, we have lost a lot of clerical and wage-grade employees to contractors. And those people go to the private sector. Those jobs are performed in the private sector. But when the comparisons are made to the average salary of the federal worker, and we're looking at the professional and technical salaries, and we've eliminated or lost a large part of our lower paid employees, and then we are making a comparison with our wages to service employees, many of the service employees in the private sector and people that barely make a minimum wage, then it looks as though our salaries are inflated when actually they're not. Because if you look at the professional work performed by scientists and our doctors and the research that they do, and compare their wages to what's done in the private sector with those professionals in the research and the chemical industry and the pharmaceutical industry, there really isn't any comparison. Federal employees have been proven time and time again to be underpaid. The proof also exists with the Department of Labor. When they do their wage surveys and their evaluations, they see that the federal worker has been underpaid for decades. In fact, at one point, we were 25% below the private sector. And over the last 20 years, that has been reduced only by 3%. We are still 22% below those jobs that are similarly identified in the private sector. But there are many studies by conservatives that are skewed and don't really represent a fair picture of what the government workers are being paid. And I think that is really escalated by high unemployment rates. When you get 10 million people that are laid off, government workers become a good target. They become a good scapegoat for reducing so-called bloated government. Let's reduce the pay, let's reduce the benefits, and let's put these people in a lower category. But what federal workers have done over the years with unions and managing to hold on to the benefits they have, the retirement benefits, their payment for health care, has really held the line for middle-class America and really what is left of middle-class America, because everyone knows that with these programs like NAFTA and CAFTA that have taken jobs for the last couple of centuries offshore, this has caused a forced reduction in the pay and the retirement benefits of workers. And that type of impact has a rippling effect. Our job as union people and federal employees is not to be involved in the race to the bottom, but to try to pull others up to where we are. And the emphasis should not be on whether or not we're overpaid or whether or not we're lazy. It should be whether or not we can get the administration, this and any other administration, to agree to have some stopgap measures in sending good jobs outside of the United States and begin to reverse the trend to lower wages and benefits.
And as we come into our last 2 minutes here, I guess, you know, one of the things people may need to be thinking about, and I'm wondering whether you're getting this from the folks in your district, you know, you've got people out there that are, you know, at the borders patrolling it. You've got people that are in the Bureau of Prisons with some of the toughest criminals out there. I mean, these are people that you would normally think should be thanked for their service, and this is the thank you for their service. Are you finding that folks are kind of angry out in the field about some of this?
Well, I think that people are angry generally. Federal employees are really a cosmopolitan or representation of the public in general. They feel that they are being attacked unfairly, it's like, for instance, the police force. If you don't have a problem with the police force, you can refer to them as those pigs. But the minute something happens in your neighborhood or in your household where you need 911 immediately, then they're heroes. And that's the way we are. We are really unsung heroes that do get a lot of criticism. And again, this is not to say that there is any perfection in any organization, but I think the surveys that show that 3 out of 4 people that interact with federal employees are positive about their experience. And we just have to ourselves as federal workers keep that in mind. Sure, we're going to be upset about the overall economy, and we should be, because that means that we're going to go to the polls and vote in our best interest. And we see from what has happened in the past historically where our best interest lies.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government. But listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me. I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Jay Nygaard, AFGE District 8 National Vice President. Welcome back to Inside Government.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little about the Washington Post poll this week that described Americans as having a negative view about federal employees. What's the reaction to the members in your area?
I think they were dismayed to find that the general public doesn't really understand what federal employees do for them. And also the fact that they felt that they were overpaid when they know that they're paid less in the private sector.
And are you getting a lot of phone calls? Are people angry about this? Are you feeling that, you know, folks are going to be speaking out or doing something about this in your area?
Well, I think more than anger, I think they're angry at the perception that they think that federal employees are overpaid and underworked and are lazy, basically. But I think that they really see it as maybe a chance for us to try to educate the public as to what federal employees do and the positive impact we make on the nation.
And what's been
so we're going to take this as an advantage to educate people, I guess is what I'm saying.
And what's been your personal reaction to this?
Well, I found it interesting that of the people that were polled, that only, I think, 35% had any interaction with federal employees, and those that had interaction felt that the federal employees did a very good job in providing services to the public. And I also found it interesting that of all of those polls, that even though some of them ranked us as overpaid and lazy employees, that yet they suggested, I think it was over 60% or whatever, 76% maybe, that said that they would recommend having a relative or a friend work for the federal government.
And do you think that there's a problem maybe with the perception and the analysis? I mean, when I think about most private sector places, I don't think of them as hiring rocket scientists, but obviously at NASA, we do. You know, there are certain levels of sophistication, obviously the VA.
Right, and that was my question. Who did they compare us to? You know, I mean, if you look at the number of highly educated people that work at the VA hospitals, we have researchers that work on controlling disease. We have surgeons, you know, that we know are underpaid compared to the private sector, but work for the VA because they want to serve the public and because they want to serve the veterans. You know, that's just the VA. There's tons of highly paid people there because they're highly educated and we want qualified people. Then you could go to the USDA where we have researchers and scientists who work to ensure that that viruses, their reference lab actually for the world, and they work on viruses that are sent from all over the world to make sure that we can find a vaccine to stop whatever virus there is, or to, if there's a bug that's out there in the wine country up in North Dakota, they have that little fruit fly that possibly could destroy crops, and they work on trying to figure out how they can, eradicate that insect. So, I mean, there's tons of stuff that impacts us, and the people that we hire are highly qualified. They're scientists, they're researchers, they're doctors, they're nurses, and the only way you're going to get people is to pay them properly. So it would be interesting to figure out who they compared us to.
And also, in some ways, who they're talking about. I mean, maybe it's also people that understand what the federal government does. I mean, it's not just AFGE folks. I mean, but obviously, we've got the people that are guarding the most serious violent offenders in federal prisons, people that are on the border patrolling it, the ICE officers. But, I mean, you're also, when you talk about the federal government, you're also talking about the FBI, the DEA. These people put their lives
right
on the line for Americans every single day.
Well, I think that's exactly the problem, is that people don't know what the federal government does and what we actually do for them, and I think it's going to have to be our responsibility to educate people. I mean, I was a federal employee for many, many years, and I really wasn't even aware myself of all the things the federal employees did, from meat inspectors to deportation officers to Border Patrol to BOP, you know, to et cetera, et cetera, until I got into this position, which is with AFGE.
And let's talk about that from your perspective, what you've seen. For instance, the VA. I mean, if you compare, and we start talking about this, some of the doctors that work at the VA, if you were a specialist in some of the areas that we have doctors and nurses at the VA in, if they were in the private sector and they were specialists in the field and set up their own private medical, you know, professional situation, they'd be making an incredible amount of money. Is that true?
Well, I know that just recently, the Minneapolis VA, which is a big VA, we were trying to hire, and management was trying to hire a nurse anesthetist, nurse manager, and they had a candidate, and they offered the person the job, and they turned it down because they were thousands of dollars, tens of thousands probably, short of what this person would take in order to come to the VA. So now they have to go out and try to recruit somebody else who maybe isn't into it for so much for the money but wants the job because they want to serve.
And let's talk about the possible effect. I mean, if some of the proposals that are out there, and there's certainly a wide variety of them, were to come true where federal pensions were cut, federal pay was cut, healthcare benefits for federal employees were cut, if those things start to come to fruition, how will that affect the federal government and employees? Do you think they'll leave?
That's a huge concern of mine because I think that, you know, quite honestly, there's a lot of federal employees that probably are up for retirement in the next few years, the baby boomers, let's say. And, I mean, if we're going to cut wages or freeze wages or cut benefits, and we already know that we're not overpaid, how are we going to ever recruit qualified people to take on these jobs, people that want to serve, you know, the federal government? And I think that my fear is that if they do these things, that the impact on the general public, then they're going to realize what federal employees do, and we don't want to go there. We'd rather educate the general public knowledge to what we do and hope that we can hire highly qualified people and pay them properly.
And there's other issues that I guess people don't even think about when you're comparing the public sector and private sector. I'm thinking back to Oklahoma City where there was the bombing. You think back to 9/11 and people that worked at the Pentagon. I mean, people in federal facilities actually frequently work in some level of danger. You've got federal employees who have to have security clearances that you don't generally need in the private sector. I mean, aren't those the kind of things that, you know, make it more difficult to attract and retain federal employees?
Right, and I mean, you do have to have security clearances in many of the jobs. I mean, today I'm off at Air Force Base, but I mean, not just security clearances. You also have background checks, and they're pretty thorough background checks on any employee who works for the federal government. So, I think that there's a lot of issues, and I think there's a lot of discussions that need to be had to try to remedy the resolve that people think that federal employees are overpaid and lazy.
What do you think we can do to turn this around? What are some of the things that are ideas that maybe you have or other folks in your area have brought to you?
As to how to educate the general public?
Yeah.
I think that, well, for one thing, I think it would be nice if we somehow got it out there that even federal employees need to start talking to their neighbors. I mean, when I had talked to my neighbors during the furlough that we had a few years ago, I mean, they had no idea what happened. You know, the federal employees were working without any wages and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that we really need to, all of us, the federal employees, need to get out there and talk about what we do on just a daily basis to people we know. But I also think as a union that we need to get out there and we need to educate the public. Maybe we need more PR. We need positive PR. And for when we get all of this these negative comments about federal employees, we need to rebut everything they say about us. We need to prove. I mean, within the VA hospitals themselves, the patient satisfaction within VA hospitals is higher than any private sector. You know, VA hospitals monitor errors and stuff. That doesn't happen in the private sector. We need to talk about the positive things that we do as federal employees in all agencies.
And do you think the federal employees themselves, both members of AFG, but I'm even thinking people that are not members, not in bargaining units, need to go out and really step it up a bit? I mean, I've seen state employees where there have been furloughs kind of sit back and say, well, I've been furloughed, so therefore I'm going to blame the union or I'm not going to contribute to anything and I'm not going to step up.
Right.
But, you know, do you wait and let that happen or do you fight this perception that, well, what's going to happen is going to happen anyway, that, you know, people in the federal government know, I mean, they play a role in making a difference in this country. And now, for their own self-interest, they're going to need to make a difference and explain to people what they do.
Exactly. We have to stop being complacent and allowing people to continue to use this as a target. And so that's something we're going to have to do as a union, and I think we're going to have to be a little bit more out there and rebut everything they say about us and show them, prove to them, and also ask Washington Post, who did they compare us to? And do they even have any idea what kind of people work for the federal government and what are the actual wages of people that are secretaries and the lower paid people versus doctors and research and scientists that are making sure that our food is safe or our veterans are taken care of properly?
Do you think in some ways, depending on polls and how they work, I mean, some of us were, before the show got started, we were watching one of those quick video clips of the guy running for office on the rent is too high party. I mean, everybody feels their rent's too high. Everybody feels everybody else is doing better than them. It's almost like the grass is always greener on the other side. Do you think in some ways if people really explore this, that maybe they'd have a very different view, and that's why that other poll, talking with people who interact with the federal government, see it differently?
I think that's exactly right. I think it'd be interesting to have a poll with people who only interacted with the federal government and see how that came out. I think it'd be a whole different ball game then.
And you think maybe also they need to compare what people are making in the private sector that are doing government contracting? I mean, isn't that almost a fair comparison? And even with that, you'd have to factor in that some of those folks are retirees and are already getting their health care and got their training from the federal government.
Exactly. I mean, you could look at the shadow workforce, and nobody ever talks about that because those are contractors. And a lot of people like to hire contractors and want to continue to try to contract out the federal government. But the shadow workforce, I mean, we can't even, I don't think the federal government even has a full inventory of how many contractors work for the federal government. So that issue needs to be addressed. And what type of quality of work do they do, and how much does that actually cost us? You know, so, I mean, there's a lot of things that we need to start debating. And it needs to be broader, and it needs to be more targeted to the general public. You know, we can talk about it. We know what's right or wrong, but we need to target it, and we need to have somehow get the media to want to listen to our story.
Do you think, as we come into our last 30 seconds, that this is just an election ploy to make federal employees a punching bag for some people running for office? Or do you think that there's a deeper problem that we really need to address?
I think that we've been targeted for a long, long time. And I think now it's really coming to the forefront because it is an election year. But federal employees are always a target. You know, I mean, if the budget isn't balanced, or if we're short on funds, and if people don't want to raise their taxes or whatever, it's always the first person they go for. It's, gee, look at the federal government. It's huge. It's too big. We don't need big government, blah, 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 blah. But they never really say what they want to take away with the federal government or how it would impact the general public if they did try to get rid of the federal government or decrease the number of federal employees.
Research shows continuing your education is the best way to increase your earning potential. Grantham University can give you the education you've always wanted. With their exclusive partnership with AFGE, you'll receive discounted tuition available to AFGE members and their families. Grantham's degree programs are 100% online to fit your busy schedule. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Want a new PC? Only Dell can offer AFGE members the lowest prices guaranteed. During the month of October, double your AFGE discount on all Dell PCs. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Up next is Jason Fornicola's interview with former NASA astronaut Dr. Bernard Harris.
We've been joined by Dr. Bernard Harris, author of Dreamwalker, A Journey of Achievement and Inspiration. Dr. Harris is also a former federal employee through NASA, the first African-American to spacewalk, and he is also the president of the Harris Foundation. You wear a number of hats. Welcome to the program.
I do. I actually had one more to add to that list, and that is I'm president CEO of Vesalius Ventures, which is a venture capital firm. So.
Perfect. Let's start about going down the road of your book. Give us a preview of what the readers can look forward to.
The book is really about my story. It tells a story from my childhood, why I decided to be an astronaut and be a physician and now be involved in business. But I wanted to do a little bit more than a typical astronaut book, telling what it's like to travel in space. People want to know that, but I also wanted to share sort of lessons learned through my life.
Dr. Harris, tell us about why you wanted to become an astronaut. You know, a lot of times kids grow up and they say, I want to be an astronaut, I want to be a doctor, I want to be... Well, you found a way to become both. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so when I was 13 years old, 1969, we landed on the moon. And when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin said those wonderful words, did that wonderful task, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, it was a tremendous leap for this little kid at the time to look at that television and decide to follow in their footsteps. And that's how it really started. And then as I began to research NASA, we didn't have internet back in those days, so I had to go to the library. Most of what was happening in the space program, of course, was from the newspapers and from television. Mm-hmm. But I learned that, you know, I needed to go to school. Mm-hmm. I needed to go to college. I found out that there were doctors who worked in the space program, and I decided that I would become a medical doctor. And that was part of the reason to becoming a medical doctor and then eventually going into space.
And so talk a little bit about that path and maybe some of the challenges that you faced along the way. Obviously, getting to the moon, getting to outer space is not an easy task. Talk about maybe some of the ways you had to persevere, overcome some obstacles and challenges.
Well, you know, the first obstacle was what I saw on that television. You know, I'm an African American, and as I looked at that television, I did not see people of color going into space. In fact, there were no women that were visible in the space program. So right off the bat, if I wanted to be an astronaut, I really didn't look like those guys, so I had to draw from inner strength and strength from the family to say that, you know, despite not seeing someone who looks like me, I'm going to do it. I'll be the first. And, of course, I wasn't the first. That was done by Guy Pluford, who eventually flew, who's also a good friend of mine and a mentor. So that was probably the first challenge to overcome, and that's a sort of a mental one, right? In my book, I talk about, you know, a lot of the issues and challenges that I face, and more than that, try to relay how I overcame them, sidestepped them, jumped over them, whatever it took to accomplish my goal.
Share with us a personal story or two, something that you can sort of whet the reader's appetite in what they can find in your book.
Well, the book does, I think, a good job of describing what it's like to be blasted off in space. You know, many people don't realize that the vehicle in which we fly weighs 5 million pounds. In order to get that 5 million pounds in the air, we have to light 5 engines. They produce a thrust of 7.5 million pounds. And I'm here to tell you that when those babies light, you're leaving this planet, and nothing's going to hold you to it. And it is a violent ride. That's the only way to describe it. It's shaking back and forth in every direction. It's extremely loud. We're able to accelerate from zero to 100,000 feet in 2 minutes, going 2,500 miles an hour, and then another 6 minutes, 6.5 minutes, to space. So think about that. Leaving Florida, 8.5 minutes later, when I got out of my seat to look at planet Earth, I was looking at Europe in that period of time. So leaving Florida, all across the Atlantic Ocean, by the time I got out and took my first view of the Earth, there it was. I had traveled literally almost, you know, halfway around the world. Pretty cool.
Take me back to the first time you launched and went into space, and you're going up and you're making that 8.5 minute trek. What's going through your mind?
Well, you know, it starts before that, about 30 minutes before. I remember on my first mission saying, what in the heck am I doing here?
What have I gotten myself
into? At that point, they had locked the door, and so I couldn't get out. No turning back at that point. At about 5 seconds, they light the main engines, and that's when you really feel it. Mm-hmm. That's 1.5 million pounds coming from the 3 engines from the shuttle. And the whole thing just shakes. It really gets your attention. And then a solid rocket motor's light, bringing in another 6 million pounds, and that's when you get catapulted, almost like being shot out of a cannon. And I just remember that it was a tremendous ride. Things sort of passed very quickly, but at times in slow motion, if you could imagine that, because you're seeing it for the first time. And I just recall once I had reached orbit, and those main engines cut off, and I went from being pushed back in my seat to 3 times my weight to zero gravity in an instant. What a relief. And I turned to my crew member next to me and I went, wow, what a ride. We did it.
Did you find yourself at any point during the trip reflecting, despite working towards the task ahead, but recognizing maybe all of the hard work and sacrifice and effort that it took for you just to get to that point?
You know, I've thought about that in different, you know, segments of my life, you know, growing up, realizing that anything that's worth its salt, anything that's considered to be quote-unquote a great accomplishment, mm-hmm. takes a lot of sacrifice, takes a lot of risk. And I think, you know, blasting off in space is one of those things that really exemplifies what a person has to do in life in order to achieve something. You have to be willing to take the first step. You have to be willing to risk. And if you're not willing to do that, then life, at least for me, is pretty dull. But I can tell you the alternative of taking that risk means that you can soar to incredible heights, literally and figuratively.
To tie it in here, today we're at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation's annual legislative conference. Yeah. Talk a little bit about what you're doing here today, what your role is, and what you hope to accomplish from being here.
Well, primarily I was invited here by the CBC to participate in the Brain Trust that focuses on STEM education. My foundation focuses on K through 12 education programs, and so we are about ensuring that our kids graduate from high school but go on to college. If they go into college, they go in those fields around STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So primarily I'm here as an advocate of that, trying to figure out how can we turn what's happening in America around, where our kids are no longer trying to become astronauts or trying to be engineers or trying to be inventors. If we don't do that, if we don't turn this around, innovation leaves this country. It's already leaving this country. Sure. Expertise leaves this country. And we've got to do something. And so I'm here to do my part, at least my part in that. We have programs in which we support all across the nation. And thanks to support that we've gotten from the ExxonMobil Foundation, we're able to have our interactive summer science camps in 30 universities nationally. We're able to do our Dream Tour, which advocates math and science education. We have other partners like the FBI that are part of our crime prevention program in the Houston area, in communities and schools. And I can go through a whole list of partnerships because this issue really requires all parties, all communities getting together to solve it. I can't solve it alone.
Now, every time we talk to the CBCF, they constantly stress to us their focus on education. You obviously know the importance of education. Talk about how improvements in education and really focusing on education, developing our young people, how that could, in a way, offset any future crises we may face in terms of a downturn in the economy, people struggling to find jobs.
If we had this initiative on STEM education 20 years ago, where we really emphasized math and science, and when I say 20 years ago, it's probably more like 15 years ago, so that the people who are coming out of college now would be majoring in these fields of engineering and math and science. We would be producing more engineers and more scientists, more innovators, and we wouldn't be having this brain drain that's happening right now, which I think is in part the issue that we're facing in this country. You cannot solve problems without having knowledgeable people. And unfortunately, our people have, there's no other way to put it, have gotten dumber, in a sense. And at least less smart in math and science and technology, which, if you look around, drives everything that we do right now. Okay, so now if our kids are not, you know, majoring in these fields, but they're living in a world that requires that they have technological skills and expertise in, then we lose. So what are we doing now? We are bringing folks from other countries coming here, and they're training to be engineers. If you look at the number of engineers that have degrees that were graduating in U.S. versus India and China, I think you've probably heard that tale. The same thing is happening in medical school. The same thing is happening in a lot of professional schools. So if we continue down that road, then this trouble, simply put, is in trouble.
And so is this a big push, a big initiative by your foundation, the Harris Foundation?
It is certainly a big initiative by our foundation. We think that the way in which to solve future problems is to prepare our kids today.
Any final thoughts that you have? Anything you'd like to share?
Just that, the book Dreamwalker is more than just a story about an astronaut going into space. What I tried to do is to provide a template, a model, for young people to be inspired to set goals in life and be willing to step out and to take that walk into their future.
Thank you to our guests this week, Washington Post reporter Ed O'Keefe, AFGE National Vice Presidents Dorothy James and Jane Nygaard, and former NASA astronaut Dr. Bernard Harris. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and Dell.